Welcome in to First Things First. I'm Sarah Kustak alongside Chris Broussard and Chris Canty, of course, filling in for Jenna, Nick, and Chris. Good morning, guys. You guys are sharp. Welcome.
Well, I mean, that's what happens
Chris
when you
Canty,
have two nukes on the
right. We
know.
Fraternity brothers, so we're known for being sharp.
Okay. I was wondering what that was.
But you got a rose right here between two thorns.
That's right.
That's what it is.
I like it. All right, we're ready to get this started. We're going to do so with LeBron James, who said his playoff intensity had been activated. He needed it last night. Lakers rallied from down 19 in the third to take down the Rockets 111-106. LeBron James led the way with 29 points, 11 boards, and 6 assists. Lakers now back at 500 and 2.5 games back of the 8th seed. Here's LeBron after the win.
You know, we got a fresh start for us, and that's the second half of the season. You know, the trade deadline is over with. This is our squad. I'm happy with who we got. I love our squad, and I look forward to seeing how we continue to battle for the rest of the season.
All right, Chris, did LeBron prove that he could carry the Lakers to the postseason?
I think he did. I mean, he was fantastic last night. Early on, you know, he had some trouble finishing around the rim in the first half. But he got going, and down the stretch, you know, early in the season when he was healthy, before he got hurt, they had several games that were winnable that he and his teammates did not close. And if they had closed those games, they probably wouldn't be in this position that they are right now. But last night, he closed. They were down 7 with about 7.5 minutes left. He scores 8 points, had that tremendous drive and dunk, which was one of the best dunks I've seen this year by anybody. I mean, that was powerful. That was turn back the clock. LeBron, he also had 2 assists, big assist to Reggie Bullock for a 3-pointer that kind of sealed the deal. That was a 17-4 run that turned a 7-point deficit into a 6-point lead and sealed the deal. So I thought LeBron was great defensively. He was hustling. You know, that's been a problem with him this year. He hasn't been great defensively. He took a key charge late in the game. Offensively, I thought he played off the ball as well as I've seen in a while. He moved without the ball. He was in the post. And defensively, he guarded Clint Capella at times, which he doesn't always like guarding centers. Not that Capella's Hakeem Olajuwon, but still, he's a center. He's a big man. And so it gave off the air of, I'm willing to do whatever it takes. He had put the pressure on himself by saying, I'm activated. It's playoff LeBron. And he had to go out there and prove it. And remember, this wasn't, you know, the Phoenix Suns. This was a very good team in Houston that needed a win. I mean, they're very good, but they've won only 4 of 9 with Chris Paul back in the lineup. They're 11-10 in their last 21 games. So they were in search of a win, too. I thought Chris Paul played one of his better games. It's late, he didn't do as much, but he was really good early on the first 3.5 quarters. And so I thought it was a great win for the Lakers, and LeBron led the way.
No, I thought it was a great win for the Lakers. And, of course, LeBron was the closer in that game. 16 of his 29 points came in the second half, and the Lakers finished that game outscoring the Rockets 51-27. But I think that speaks to LeBron trying to set the tone for the younger players. And the thing that I was probably most impressed with was those young guys coming to the party. And so I think the All-Star break gave those guys an opportunity to regroup, because the last several months, their names have been mentioned in trade rumors. And so that was put to bed during the week's rest. And then they had an opportunity to regroup, refocus. And then, of course, LeBron making his comments public about the intensity that he's going to approach the game with. I thought that Kyle Kuzma and Brandon Ingram in particular took their games to another level as well. And you saw LeBron trust Brandon Ingram down the stretch a little bit as well. You remember that sequence of plays after LeBron gets that dunk when he's matched up one-on-one and Clint Capella. They go down, they get a stop, P.J. Tucker misses a corner three, and then LeBron tells Brandon Ingram to go ahead and push it, and then Brandon Ingram takes it to the hole and gets an and one. So, I mean, that's a situation where LeBron is realizing that in order to get where he wants to go, which is making the postseason for a 14th consecutive year, he's going to need those young guys to play a big part in that.
To me, that's the difference, because there was never a question about can LeBron lead this team to the playoffs. It's what are some of those players going to do around him? And when he said that he's activated, there was a difference, and obviously he looked different. He looked more spry. He was explosive. How he actually played and produced on the floor, there was a difference in his engagement with those young guys. And not to say that he has not done that at points throughout the season, but he was in their ear. He was communicating with them. He seemed more positive, more encouraging, you know, trying to explain things on the floor. And to me, that's going to be the difference, because he had talked about how he loves to be in an uncomfortable situation. He thrives, you know, when there is chaos going around him. But are other players going to thrive?
Right.
And that's, and especially when it's young guys, it's new guys, it's guys that have not been in the midst of a playoff run. So to me, that's going to be one of the most key components, is how can he continue to not only perform the way he does, facilitate, distribute, but lead them in a manner of which they feel comfortable.
I thought Chris made a great point with Ingram. I mean, imagine if you're Brandon Ingram, you were in the trade rumors. Everybody's talking about you're not performing well. Kyle Kuzma's better than you, even though you were the second pick. And to have the best player in the world telling you, key game, look, take it, don't give it to me. That's huge for his confidence. That was probably one of the best games of Ingram's career.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, 13 rebounds to go with. I think he had 27 points. And then Kuzma, it wasn't one of his greatest games, but he was solid. He had 18 points, shot about 50% from the floor. And there was an incident where he and LeBron were going back and forth on the bench.
Mm-hmm.
And I like the fact that Kuzma didn't respond negatively to that. He came out. He still played well. He still hit some shots. So, yeah, the young guys play. Look, this is playoff basketball for the Lakers for the rest of the way. It's going to, if they make it, even if they get beat by Golden State in four or five games, it'll be good for the young guys to have that experience. You have to have that at some point, but they're getting it now. These next 24 games are playoffs for the Lakers.
What do you think it'll be like reintegrate when Lonzo Ball does come back? Because they've got Reggie Bullock in the starting line. He was very efficient. I mean, he hit a key three at the end of the game.
Yes.
Four of eight.
He's their best three-point shooter.
From beyond the line. And he's
and they need that,
shooter.
Though. You need somebody.
He's
gonna be
excellent. A good free-throw shooter, too.
But I think they have him in that starting lineup, so then they can just reinsert Lonzo Ball in and not mess up what's happening with the rotation second unit. How challenging do you think that will be when Ball does come back to just reacclimate him to how they're playing, what they're doing, and just get that type of chemistry within the rotation?
Well, I think it'll be a learning curve for Lonzo, because there's a very specific style that the Lakers are going to have to play, because LeBron James is very specific in terms of what he wants the game to look like, the complexion of it. And I think last night was classic LeBron. He dictated the tempo of that game, and you saw that. And the four matchups that they've had with the Rockets this season, this was the lowest scoring affair. And so I think that LeBron being able to get guys involved in the half-court sets offensively paid dividends for them defensively, because you saw Luke Walton said that they got their defensive mojo back a little bit. So when guys feel like they're involved on the offensive side of the court, there's a little more incentive for them to play defense, just because you want to get back on offense and get an opportunity to score. So I think that Lonzo Ball has to recognize how this team has to play, what their identity has to be if they're going to qualify for the postseason.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting, because Lonzo has been a very good defender for them. When he's on the court, their defense is much better. To your point, though, they played really good defense last night without him. I don't know how much they need him offensively. So, like, Reggie Bullock, if he continues to play this way and shoot the three ball well, then it's going to be tough for Lonzo to get in there. I mean, you're going to give him some minutes, but, you know, you need more of a shooter.
Do you think they would potentially just bring him off the bench?
He's not of the stature where it's like, we got to play Lonzo. We have to start Lonzo. At this point, it's the best players that we can put on the floor around LeBron to win, and you need a shooter. And Lonzo's not a shooter, not to mention he shoots 41% from the free throw line. And last night, surprisingly, they shot 82% from the free throw line. If they go back to shooting as poorly as they have all year, that could really hurt them, because they're going to be in close games down the stretch. And if they're not making free throws, that'll be bad. But, yeah, it's going to be interesting, because defensively they do need him.
Mm-hmm.
But if they're going to play defense like they did last night without him, I think it's going to be an interesting thing to see how they put him in. I thought Rondo was good. His stats weren't really impressive. 2 points, 1 for 4 from the floor, even a negative 9 plus minus. But I thought he was pretty effective out there with LeBron. So I think maybe Rondo's minutes could be the ones that get challenged by Lonzo if Bullock shoots the ball well.
All right. Great stuff, guys. Coming up, should Zion shut it down even if he's healthy? That's next on FS1. And you can always check us out on the Fox Sports channel on SiriusXM. We will be right back. We'll get to Zion Williamson in a second, but first, the NBA is back. Celtics, Bucks, Giannis Antetokounmpo chases down Jason Tatum. Look at that block.
Chase down block.
Giannis just keeps coming at you.
That's why he's an MVP in my book, at least right now.
Yeah, he had one earlier in the game on Terry Rozier, too. Really impressive what he's doing, not only on offense, but on the defensive end.
All over the place. Kings, Warriors, Kevin
KD,
Durant.
KD, though.
We're showing some defense.
That's one up in Giannis. I like that one better than Giannis's.
Big old block on Buddy Hield. He had 7 blocks last night.
KD at 7?
KD did.
Wow.
Yeah, Blazers Nets. Ooh. Yeah, I saw this one up close, and I didn't like the way it ended. Yusuf Nurkic, though.
Thunderous.
Nice job over D'Angelo Russell.
That is nice.
Joe Harris.
Don't jump, Jared Allen. Don't jump.
He always jumps.
He said, I'm going to be on the highlight either way. That's what we appreciate about him. Lakers, Rockets, playoff LeBron. Yep, he's been activated. It shows. That's what you were talking about.
There it is. That's it right there.
Jaw dropping. That looked good.
Clint Capella knows he's got no chance right now.
I mean, that came out of nowhere.
But you added about it being a big win against Houston, the fact that it was Capella's first game back, too.
Yep.
Back to Zion Williamson. He is listed as day-to-day with a grade 1 knee sprain after his injury scare on Wednesday night. And while Coach K is optimistic the freshman phenom will return to the floor soon, former Kentucky star DeMarcus Cousins has some advice for Zion. Take a listen.
Well, knowing what I know now, college is bull. College basketball, NCAA is bull. So my advice to him is do what's best for you and your family. And obviously, college isn't. It does nothing for you at this point. You've proven you're the number one pick coming out. You've proven your talent. You know, get ready for the next level because it's happening. That's my opinion, knowing what I know now.
Cansey, what do you think? Should Zion shut it down for the rest of the year?
Well, first, I hear Boogie Cousins' comments, and I mean, I guess we all know that collegiate athletics is an exploitative system. I mean, the amateurism model by the NCAA is broken. I think everybody understands that. If you don't believe that, that's naive. That's just being naive, because these athletes are generating hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars for the NCAA. But that aside, in looking at Zion's decision to go to Duke, I mean, you have to weigh the risk-reward in terms of him coming back. If he's 100% healthy, then I think he absolutely should come back and play this season under Coach K, because the coaching that he's getting potentially could be better than the coaching that he's getting for whatever team takes him in the lottery. So I look at this situation and say there is something to be gained for Zion by coming back, because getting the tutelage of Coach K is going to be one of those things that could help him transition smoothly to the next level. Because the jump from college to pro is always bigger than the jump from high school to college. And so I look at, because it's basketball and the nature of the game of basketball, it's not necessarily the risk of injury that you would see in other sports like football or like in hockey. So I think that if the opportunity is there, if he's healthy before the end of the season, then he should absolutely come back and play.
I texted with some NBA guys about this, not players, but like coaches, executive scouts yesterday. Two told me that Zion needs to be very careful. And don't come back until he's, like you said, 100%, okay? And if that means missing, I think they have 5 regular season games left. If that means missing all 5 of those, whatever it takes, just make sure you're healthy, however many games you have to miss. One told me he would love to see Zion fight through this and show that competitiveness that you really want to see and play. Another told me he shouldn't sit out because ballers ball, all right? But all of them, when I said, okay, if he decides to sit out, will that affect his draft stock? And they said, absolutely not. He's still the number one choice going away. It's not even close. My feeling is that he should get a second opinion. You know, not that the Duke doctors aren't great or whatever, but get a second opinion. And until you don't come back until you feel as good as you did 3 or 4 days ago, and until you can move as well and be as explosive, if doctors are like, look, you can play, your explosiveness won't be there initially, you won't move like you used to, it'll be a little sore, but eventually it'll come through. I'm like, no. Sit down. Wait till you are absolutely ready to start playing in games. And I'm with you. If he's 100%, if I were his parent and I was advising him, I would first see if he really wants to play. Mm-hmm. I assume he does. If he's like, I really do want to play, I'm like, look, once you're totally 100% and the Zion of last week, then okay, you can get out there. But I'll say this. If he were to come out, he and his family tonight, and they say, look, Zion's dream ever since he was a young boy was to play in the NBA. And after what happened the other day, we saw how vulnerable he could be as a collegiate athlete. So we're going to sit it out and start preparing for the NBA draft. I would have absolutely no problem with that because I understand it's a business decision, mm-hmm. and that's the ultimate dream is to get to the NBA.
Well, and I also think, and we all know this, haven't played different sports, you may tweak your knee and it's getting back healthy, but your gait is different. So then all of a sudden you do something to your hamstring or your hip or, you know, everything is all connected in a way of which maybe his knee is almost healthy, but all of a sudden something else happens.
You overcompensate.
Couldn't agree more about him being entirely healthy, it being entirely his decision. I don't think there should weigh at all about his competitiveness or want to win by any NBA guy. I don't think that factors in. Mm-hmm. Do you think in any way, having played college sports, having played pro sport, does he owe anything to his teammates? Like, not thinking about the NCAA, not thinking about anything else. Mm-hmm. But do you think there's something to be said for those other guys that he's been going through the season with?
That's important to consider the relationship that he has with the teammates and then the goals that they set for themselves as a team coming into this season. But I think his teammates understand the situation that he's in. And so if he's going to make that decision to sit out, as long as he tells those guys first, then I wouldn't have a problem with him making that decision public. If he decides that he wants to come back and play, whether it's the ACC tournament or the NCAA tournament, whatever decision that he makes, I'm fine with. I just want him to have 100% conviction on it. And then, of course, if he does decide to come back and play, it's up to Coach K and the medical staff to also make sure that he's 100%. Because you could be in situations sometimes as a coach or the medical staff where you have to protect the player from himself.
Right.
And so that's the one thing that you do want to be concerned with. And, of course, the way that Zion plays, he's very aggressive. I mean, you have to make sure that he's 100% ready to go because so much of his game right now is predicated on his athleticism. But as far as how the game played out the other night, I mean, you see the value of this kid to that Duke basketball team because, I mean, even though you had the other two freshman phenoms, Cam Reddish and R.J. Barrett combined for 60 points, I mean, that game wasn't competitive. I mean, the game was essentially over when Zion got hurt, and they missed his presence more so on the defensive end than they did on the offensive end. And I was surprised that Coach K didn't even have any answers in terms of how to try to make some plays and get the momentum to come back in their favor, whether it was schemes or whatnot. But in terms of the value that he brings to a basketball team, I mean, Zion is a two-way player. He can affect the game with the ball in his hands or with the ball without having the ball. And so I think that's probably the most impressive thing for me at such a young age, realizing that there are so many other facets where he can have an impact on his team winning.
I might even call him a three-way player. Like you said, he does it offensively, defensively, but he also has the intangibles. He's clearly got all the tangibles, but he has those intangibles of that hustle, playing with energy, you know, that is infectious with your team. So I think I'm going to give them a pass on the game the other night because I think the mental and emotional strain and distress that you go through when you see your best player, and they didn't know at that point how serious it was or not. We saw it with the Boston Celtics last year. Remember, Gordon Hayward goes down in the first game. Mm-hmm. They lose that one. They lose the next one, and then they run off 16 straight victories. So it takes some time to adjust. Maybe Coach K was even a bit thrown off by it. So, I do think you know how it is, Chris. Obviously, they love Zion as a teammate. But guys are also like, okay, if he's out, this is a chance for me to step up. And to your question, Sarah, I just think they all understand this kid's situation. And heck, R.J. Barrett and Cam Reddish are in the same situation. Mm-hmm. They all are going to be one and done. I'm sure they want him back, but they understand what the end game is for all of them. So I don't think it'll be a problem. Like Chris said, as long as he's respectful and approaches them first and stays supportive if he decides to sit out. He's there on the bench. He's, you know, at all the games and stuff like that.
And who knows what happens. I mean, we're talking about him getting to the NBA and being the number one overall pick, but he could potentially be one of the best players that we see play in the NBA. I mean, who knows? His goals aren't just to get to the NBA, but what he does when he gets there. So I feel like you got to think about the big picture. Coming up, why is James Harden calling out the refs? That's next on First Things First.
He's usually a ref's favorite. Most players would say he's a referee's favorite.
He should. NASCAR season heats up in Atlanta with the Folds of Honor Quick Trip 500. That's Sunday at 2 Eastern on Fox and the Fox Sports app. Time for us to go viral. Enes Kanter dropped 18 points and 9 boards in his Trailblazers debut last night. And with his team getting the victory, he threw some shade at his old Knicks squad, tweeting, "Wow, That's how winning feels. I can get used to that.
Wow. He didn't have to take it there.
You know,
why
I
not?
Like Ennis, though.
I like it.
I like he speaks his mind, and he can put up points and rebounds.
And
he can't defend.
He can't defend
a lick, but he
the
can
single
score
coverage, you can't stop him.
Yeah, he's a walking double-double, but still, man, come on, man.
Hey,
they let you go.
He went at LeBron. He went at LeBron, so he'll go at anybody.
Yeah, but throwing shade at the Knicks, he was the one that decided to opt in this year. He knew what the Knicks were doing.
Well, he got to get that money.
But he thought he would at least be playing.
Don't complain. Listen, you're getting paid $18 million.
Now it's time for your AT&T wake-up call. According to reports, the NBA is considering lowering the age limit to enter the draft from 19 to 18. The report also says this is not related to Zion Williamson's injury. Chris, would this be a good idea?
You know what? I think what's best for basketball at both levels, NCAA and the NBA, would be if players went to college for 2 or 3 years. However, what's fair in American life, in our society, is that you can go to the NBA when you're 18 years old, when you're right out of high school. I think that's more important than what might be best for the game of basketball. So, yeah, I think this is definitely going to happen. And I'm fine with it. Now you have the G League, which can serve as a buffer for those players that don't make it or get drafted. They can go to the D League. And I also think college should look at changing the rule where, look, if a kid enters the draft, doesn't get drafted, I think he should be able to go play in college. Like, I don't see why that has to be a rule. So if you put certain things in place to help the athletes as a safety net, then I'm definitely fine with it.
Yeah, Michelle Roberts and Adam Silver got to get this done, because the other two major professional sports leagues, that being hockey and baseball, you can go straight from high school to the professional ranks. It should absolutely be allowed in basketball, because we've seen some guys come out of high school and have success in the NBA.
A few.
Football is a little different, though.
Yeah, I agree. I think physically,
yeah,
99% of the kids would get maimed if they come out of high school.
Exactly.
You know?
To the Warriors, they barely beat the Kings last night, 125 to 123. Steph Curry had a casual 36 points on 10 three-pointers. Can he surprise the Warriors struggled last night?
Not surprised. First game back from the All-Star break. Those guys just trying to get back into the groove. But, I mean, Steph Curry. hits 10 three-pointers
like it's nothing,
man. I mean, this is his fifth, 10 three-pointer game this year. It's an NBA record. So, I mean, it's just amazing how he has revolutionized the game with being able to be such a prolific shooter.
I like to claim that I was the first person on air to say he's the best shooter in NBA history. I think I was.
So claim that.
Mark Jackson said Klay and Steph were the best shooting backcourt, which is true.
Mm-hmm.
I think they're the best backcourt, period, of all time. But Steph would be in the MVP race. We're talking Giannis, Paul George, James Harden, if he hadn't missed 11 games. I'm not saying he would win it, but he would be in the conversation. But only two players ever have won it while missing 11 or more games, Bill Walton and Allen Iverson. So he really doesn't have a chance.
It's been incredible. Finally, James Harden fouled out with less than a minute and a half left to play in last night's loss to the Lakers. Harden was called for 4 offensive fouls throughout the course of the game. Needless to say, he was not happy with the officiating. Take a listen.
Scott Foster, man, he's I never really talk about officiating or anything like that, but just rude and arrogant. I mean, you aren't able to talk to him throughout the course of a game. And it's like, how do you build that relationship with officials, and it's not even that call. Like, it's just, you know, who he is on that floor. It's pretty frustrating. And I mean, I'm probably going to get hit, but honestly, I don't really say anything. I'm probably a pretty quiet guy to myself, but it's one of those things where you can't voice your opinion. You can't have a conversation with someone that's officiating the game, and then, you know, you're getting a tech. It's pretty sad.
You feel like it's a personal issue?
Yeah, for sure. For sure it's personal. For sure. Like, I don't think he should be able to even, you know, officiate our games anymore, honestly.
Wow. Chris.
Very strong.
to say the least, what do you make of Harden's comments?
I know Scott Foster. Our kids went to the same acting camp before. So I like him. He's a nice guy. I understand. Everybody's going to look at Harden and say, hold on. You even players say, man, you benefit from calls more than any other player in the league, so mm-hmm. stop complaining. I get that. That's fair. But I get what Harden is saying about, and if I don't know if this is the case with Scott and players or not, but that you can't talk to him, you can't banter with him, you can't even question a call. If that's true, I get that, because a lot of officials, like Dick Bavetta, who's one of the historically great officials, he would let players talk to him, and as long as it's respectful, maybe there's you joke a little bit, and it lightens the mood. Even if it's a bad call, if you can joke with the player, then it kind of lightens it for the player, and they let it go. So I get that. You do want that as a player to just be able to, hey, what do you, you know, be able to have a conversation with them. So I get the frustration if that's what they're feeling from Scott.
Yeah, it's clear that James Harden feels away after hearing that commentary after the game. But to your point, I think the communication between the players and the officials is important because the players need to know how the official is going to be able to call the game so they can adjust accordingly. And it's clear last night that the Rockets didn't make the adjustments and the Lakers did. I mean, the Lakers doubled up on the Rockets in free throw attempts. And then, of course, James Harden and Chris Paul ultimately end up fouling out of that game. The Rockets didn't and shoot a free throw in the last 20 minutes of the game. So, I mean, there was a little bit of a confusion in terms of how you're going to officiate the game. And if we're going to say that last night's game was playoff basketball for the Lakers, then I think that it's important for both teams to have an understanding of how Scott Forster is going to officiate that game.
I also thought Harden, there was one call in particular where Rondo started kind of riding him up the court and Harden got called for an offensive foul. I thought that was shaky because it didn't look to me like Harden purposely or, you know, really tried
there's
the
no
elbow.
Extension
he
of
got
his
hit
arm
in the nose, Rondo. I thought that, look, when two stars foul out of a game, you're going to question it. In the NBA, when does that ever happen?
True. I would say Michael Smith made the call that fouled James Harden out, so it was not Scott Foster. It's been a tenuous relationship between referees and players over the course of the last year, 2 years, and there's been a lot of new referees, and so I think we have seen less dialogue or allowed dialogue between players and officials throughout the course of these last few seasons. I think
that's
maybe a little more surprising with Scott Foster since he's been reffing in the NBA for 25 years. I do think, though, to a certain extent, so I'm not saying it was necessarily this case last night. Chris Paul, you know, he was on Scott Foster last year. You remember it kind of called him out. But there's a lot of talking between players and referees. And so I think they're trying to find the balance of how much do we, we can communicate, but there's also a lot of chirping, a lot of talking.
You know,
whether it's gestures
after
every single call. And so I think there's a balance, too, between officials trying to find that ground of, okay, I don't want to listen to you after every single call.
That's a good point.
Yeah, but here's the thing. The fans are showing up to see the star players. They ain't showing up to see the guys with the whistles in their mouth.
Right.
So, I mean, well, you know, you got to make sure that the star players understand
but
how
James
you're going to call
gets
the game.
A lot of, James Harden gets a lot of calls.
If things like this keep happening where all of a sudden the Lakers are going to the line way more than their opponents and stars are getting in foul trouble, if not fouling out, then people are going to start to say, oh, they're trying to get the Lakers in the playoffs and LeBron. You know what I mean? So I'm not saying that was the case last night, but that will happen with people because the NBA has more conspiracy theories than any other league.
Well, with that being said, do you think at all in those were powerful words because James Harden didn't just attack Scott Foster in how he officiated. He said he believes it's personal. He talked about his attitude on the floor and his personality. Do you think in any way we've had so much discussion about the style of play that James Harden plays at and how he plays and, you know, if it's pleasing and do people enjoy it, do they like it? In any way, do you think that factors into the mind of officials? Do you think they start to hear some of the talk that goes around or the way in which, you know, we're starting to pick apart James Harden and his style of play?
Well, I think that could be a piece of it because perception is reality, right? And so everybody's saying that James Harden is gimmicking his way to 30-plus points a night. But at the same time, I think it's important that the officials are fair with both teams.
Right.
And so when you're trying to get insight as a player into how the official is going to call the game, I think the official has the responsibility, like it's a part of his job description, to make sure that all the players that are on the court understand how they're going to officiate the game. That's important.
Yeah.
I mean, these are the best athletes in the world, so they will be able to adjust, but you just have to establish the standard and call it fairly on both sides.
Yeah, I think to your point, it could affect the officials. Look, we've seen superstar calls for years. We saw Michael Jordan's famous shot against Utah. He clearly pushed off. And there was always talk that officials being human beings, they get it. These guys are superstars, too. And they may even be a little impacted by that where you make a call on a role player that you wouldn't make on the superstar. I mean, there's a reason you rarely see superstars get in foul trouble, right. Even though everybody's physical, you know. So, yeah, I think that could
happen. And they try to be transparent. I mean, there's the last two-minute report that come out. The NBA officials get graded
and
on
I've
every
talked
single
to referees
game.
About and, that. And I think that's unfair to referees. I got to be honest. Because there's nothing you can do. It doesn't help the team because the team is like, okay, we should have won that game. Wow, that really helps us now. And the official, it just is constantly second-guessing them. I think it's tough for officials in that regard.
It is. It's challenging. Being an official in general, a challenging job I'd never want. To the NFL,
Chris
according...
Chris got no love for my
according to
not
reports...
Not even a little bit. Not even a little bit.
Multiple Steelers veterans are not happy with general manager Kevin Colbert's praise of Big Ben earlier this week. Here's what else Colbert said. Ben Roethlisberger is unquestionably the leader of this team, not just by my standards, by the standards the team recognizes. If our players were smart, they'd listen to him because he's been there. He's done it. I honestly believe it can be a burden on him more often than he would like to admit. He has 52 kids under him. Chris Canty, have the Steelers set a bad precedent with their praise of Ben Roethlisberger?
Well, yeah, but I want to first dive into those comments that Kevin Colbert just said, referring to the other 52 guys on the team as kids.
Yeah.
Them grown-ass men out there, dog.
Thank you.
Like, what are you talking about? Like, I don't even understand that. And then when it comes to Big Ben and his criticism of teammates, I'm fine with them keeping that in-house. If he wants to approach guys in the locker room, on the practice field, or even on the sidelines in games, perfectly fine. But when you go on a radio show, when you're doing a weekly hit in Pittsburgh, and you're public about your criticism and the mistakes that your teammates have made, yet you don't accept accountability and responsibility for the mistakes that you make yourself, that's what I got a problem with. If you go back to the regular season, remember that interception that he threw at the end of the Denver Broncos game? And he says, yeah, that's not a big deal because who anticipates a defensive tackle dropping in coverage? Like you've got to accept responsibility for that. That's a situation where you stand up as the quarterback knowing your position in the organization. You've got to establish a standard. You've got to set the example for everybody on that team. If you accept accountability as the quarterback, then you force all of your other teammates to be accountable. Big Ben clearly hasn't done that with himself. And I think that's what led to the friction that you've seen with Antonio Brown in the Pittsburgh Steelers. So I just feel like the precedent that GM Kevin Colbert is setting by coming out and making these comments is a misstep. And it explains what's going on with that Antonio Brown situation. And it also explains why this team, with all the talent that they've had this decade, has only gone to one conference championship.
I agree 100% with everything you said. He went way too far. If you want to come out and say Ben is our leader, all the players know he's the leader, he's won two Super Bowls, you know, we're behind him, that's fine. He talked about Ben Roethlisberger like you would talk about a coach. And even if you talked about a coach that way, I think players would push back. Because he basically said he's beyond reproach. Right. Don't question him. Don't ask him, you know, question what he's doing is right. Just get in line. Yes, Ben. What do we need to do, Ben? How can we win? That's what he was talking about. And I think even with a coach, players got to feel like, at least I can ask about something. I can question. Well, his coach, what I'm seeing out there is this. Why don't we look, you know, like, so I think he went way too far. And to your point, I want to address the 52 kids. And look, I think there are times as an African-American in this country, because of the history of this country and the oppression, the slavery, the discrimination, and even discrimination that we still encounter today, there are times when a white person can say something without racial intent. Without racist intent. I don't know Kevin Colbert. I'm not calling him a racist. I assume he's not. He's got a black head coach. You work in a field where there are a lot of African Americans. Okay, so I don't think he had any racial intent because obviously a lot of their players are white. But when you most of their players are black.
Yes.
70% of the NFL is black. Mm-hmm. When you refer to black men as kids, it rubs me the wrong way because for the greater part of this of America's history, there has been a concerted effort to keep black men in a state of perpetual adolescence as boys. We were literally called boys when we were grown men. Mm-hmm. So, again, I don't think Kevin Colbert meant it that way. I don't think he's even aware of it. But when you call grown men, some of them who have families, who have children, kids, and you even put it in the context of being under a white man, Roethlisberger, and going further, a white guy whose character is far beyond, not beyond reproach, who's had his own issues. Come on. Like, that's how I look at it. And again, I'm not saying anything about Kevin Colbert being a racist, but this is how myself and I think a lot of African Americans look at things like this. When you refer to grown men as kids.
No, see, Chris, you're absolutely right. And it's not necessarily his intent with the message. It's how it's received by the guys in the locker room. And I don't think that's going to be one of those things that guys are going to take the right way. I think this can go sideways in a hurry. And when you couple that with the fact that Ben Roethlisberger hasn't exhibited the leadership traits that you would see from some of the other top-tier quarterbacks like Tom Brady or like a Russell Wilson, you know, that would actually bother you. So, I mean, it goes back to Ben Roethlisberger and how he goes about his business. I mean, the way that he separated himself from the other guys in the locker room creates a strained dynamic. And in the middle of all of this, you have Mike Tomlin, who's done nothing but win division titles since they installed him as the head coach. He's won a Super Bowl. He's never had a losing record in any season. This is an organization, this is a team that expects to be in the playoffs each and every season. But to see all of the things that have cropped up the last couple of years, from Antonio Brown with the Facebook Live video to Le'Veon Bell and the contract stalemate, and now this from Ben Roethlisberger and the friction that he's got with AB, I look at all of these different things and I say, this is why a talented team has fallen short of expectations.
How detrimental can this be given the time period? I mean, the assumption is that Le'Veon Bell becomes a free agent, so he may be gone. Antonio Brown, you assume he'll get traded. So maybe you're thinking you can get things back in order. Given the fact that it's the offseason, you still got some time before minicamp, things like that. What do you think the reaction will be by the team to this, and how much can this challenge that order?
Well, it's going to be hard to put the genie back in the bottle, and you also have to consider the organization's in a tough spot with Ben Roethlisberger's contract, because this is a contract year for him. It's over after 2019. So Art Rooney II has already come out on record and said he wants to extend Big Ben. And so if you're going to give a player more cash, and on top of the comments that the general manager just made, that's just further empowering Ben Roethlisberger to continue to do what he's already done in the past. And so I get a little bit worried about Mike Tomlin being able to reestablish his authority and his voice in that locker room when the general manager has already come out on record and said that the quarterback has the power to even call him out. So in an organization that has had three head coaches in the last 50 years, I think that it's Kevin Colbert's responsibility and ownership's responsibility to empower your head coach to be able to take back his locker room. You're probably going to get rid of the distraction of Antonio Brown. They already said they're not coming out and tagging Le'Veon Bell again. So those will be removed from the situation. But I think now that Kevin Colbert has made these comments, they've got some cleaning up to do in order to put Mike Tomlin in a good spot where he can get back to doing what he does best, which is coach this team.
I totally agree, because I think this was an opportunity. When you get rid of Le'Veon and Antonio, this is an opportunity to get back to the Steeler way, where you don't have these distractions, where it's all team-first personalities. But now I think you've messed that up. And I think Kevin Colbert's got a lot of work to do, because, look, you didn't hear any players come out and criticize Antonio Brown. Even as bad as what he did was by skipping out on that last game, they threw out an olive branch at the Pro Bowl. Hey, we want him back. Now, Ben, I just think that the players, you saw where Antonio said that Ben had an owner's mentality. Mm-hmm. You can see why after comments like this by the GM. So I wonder if, you know, players, they seem to be siding with Antonio, at least in terms of his character and who he is as a person. And I think that this could just divide that locker room a little bit. I don't even know. Maybe Colbert needs to come out and issue not an apology, but some type of another statement, or I didn't,
because he's got to explain. He's got to explain those comments.
If he just says he's got 52 men to lead and we got to get behind him, that's fine. Yeah. But he went way too far.
The Steelers have dealt with tumultuous situations before, and I know it's still very early, but you know L. Bell's gone, you assume Antonio Brown's gone. What are realistic expectations for this team next season?
Well, this team comes into every season trying to win the division. But when you have a quarterback that's in his late 30s and you're talking about giving him more money, there's only one reason that you're doing that. You're expecting to win a championship. And the knock on the Steelers team in the years prior to the last two seasons has been the defense hasn't been able to match what the offense is bringing to the table. But the last two seasons, they've had a top 10 defense. So really, this is on Ben Roethlisberger to get this done. If the organization is going to make a financial commitment to him and put him in this type of situation where he's at the top of the hierarchy, he's got to deliver. So I think the pressure has to be on Ben Roethlisberger, because he's shown, when you have arguably the best wide receiver in the game and you have arguably the best running back in the game, he hasn't been able to get it done. So I think a lot of what happens for this Steelers organization in the next couple of years is going to be on Big Ben. And if they give him a new contract extension, that means more pressure.
All right, back to the hardwood coming up. Did last night prove LeBron's playoff mode is activated? That's next on First Things First. Welcome back to the show. Bleacher Report senior NBA writer Howard Beck joins the show. What up, Beck?
Good morning.
It's so good to see you.
Good to see you. I'm almost awake.
He said almost awake.
I said, you look bright-eyed, bushy-tailed. Yeah. You were at the game in Brooklyn last night. Here you are on no sleep.
A little. Tiny bit.
We're excited.
Coffee.
We're excited. Keep it going. We got a lot to talk about here and taking a look at some of the teams in the East, including the big matchup last night between Kyrie and the Celtics and Giannis and the Bucks. Less than 6 minutes to go. Chris Middleton misses the shot. Outlet pass to Jason Tatum. And look at Giannis Antetokounmpo. Monster chase down block. He got it done on the defensive end. He also finished with 30 points. And then less than two to go. Celtics down one and Kyrie. Just absolutely absurd up and under. So game side in 95, and it's Chris Middleton who hits the big go-ahead three. Kyrie, a chance to win it at the buzzer. Some good defense there, and no good. Bucks win it 98-97. Howard, what did last night tell you about the East that you didn't already know?
I don't know if it told us anything that we didn't already know. I think what it reinforced is that there are no good predictions right now. There is nothing safe about the top of the Eastern Conference. If you told me that any combination of Milwaukee, Toronto, Philadelphia, Boston, whichever two, pick them out of a hat, tell me that they're in the conference finals, I will believe you. Tell me that any one of them is the team that actually emerges from the East, I will believe you. I really believe it's going to be a dogfight. These teams are so different. They're all very good. They're all strong defensively. I think if anything last night, what it reinforced too, though, is Giannis is not messing around, not when it comes to that MVP potential and not when it comes to trying to lead this team to the title.
Yeah, I'm with Howard. I mean, I don't put Philly, as talented as they are, I don't put them with Toronto, Milwaukee, and Boston. I just think that Ben and Embiid aren't quite ready yet to win at the highest level. Mm-hmm. I certainly don't think they can beat Boston. I think, you know, Brad Stevens has their number. But you're right. Those four are all very good teams. Some of the things that were reinforced last night. Kyrie Irving is probably the best closer in the league. Mm-hmm. I mean, he is downright scary at the end of a game. If you're an opponent of the Celtics or an opposing fan, I mean, he wasn't having a good game.
No.
And he just took over down the stretch, and dude is unstoppable. So that's one thing. Secondly, Milwaukee's my pick. I mean, like you said, it's hard to pick any of these three teams or four if you want to put Philly in there. But I've picked Milwaukee. The thing I like about them, Giannis is obviously great, and he's third in the league in fourth quarter scoring. However, at the end of games, what I like about them is they're different than most other teams. At the end of the game, the ball finds the open man. Mm-hmm. Even if it's not Giannis, last night it found Chris Middleton with 32 seconds left. He hits the three-pointer. Other teams, we know they're going to Kyrie. We know they may be going to Kawhi. We know they're going to LeBron or whatever. Mm-hmm. I like kind of the ball finding the open guy and empowering other guys to make a big play.
I think even that whole sequence down the stretch. I mean, we see Giannis hit a basket, Middleton with a big three, mm-hmm. Bledsoe taking it to the basket, Brogdon had a big pull-up shot. We've talked so much about the Celtics and Brad Stevens and the confidence we have in what he can do. Howard, what do you make of Mike Budenholzer now being the head coach of Milwaukee, what he's done? And also, when we bring up Toronto, Nick Nurse and just, you know, his first season as a head coach with this team, despite the continuity. Is there an edge anywhere to you in kind of how you look at the coaching and the matchups and what that may factor into when you look at these top teams in the East?
Well, it's interesting, the contrast between those two, right? Nick Nurse, a rookie head coach. Mike Budenholzer, who had not only all those years as an assistant in San Antonio, but had the experience in taking an Atlanta team that really, you know, it didn't scream star power, but they became better than the sum of their parts and a 60-win team because he maximized everybody there. That's what Mike Budenholzer is doing in Milwaukee. It's very, very rare in this league, as we all know, to take a team with no major additions. No All-Stars joined them in the summer. There was no...
Brooke Lopez isn't a major addition.
We love Brooke Lopez. We love
My
Brooke
favorite.
Lopez.
My favorite.
Ersin Ilyasova, great guy.
His, like, 10th stint with the Bucks.
But the Bucks went from middle to lower of the pack
seventh seed,
to dominant in the East with one major addition, the coach.
Mm-hmm. So I think it comes down to the defense for me, and that's why I trust the Milwaukee Bucks, because once we get to the postseason, we know the style of basketball changes compared to what we see in the regular season. So if you ask me, what did we learn about the East last night? I think we learned that it's probably going to be a two-team race, and I think those are going to be the two teams left standing at the end, just because of what you talked about with Kyrie being one of the best closers in the game. And Boston is a deep team. Now, granted, they haven't learned how to play together yet because you have Kyrie, and he's been a bigger part. You know, he dealt with the injuries last year, and so you have Gordon Hayward. He had the injury last year. I think they're still trying to figure out how to play with one another, but I think they're taking steps in the right direction. And now is the time of the season where we see these teams ratchet up the intensity a little bit. So when I looked at that game last night, I mean, you're really one foul call away from Kyrie hitting two free throws and that being the game winner. It's a situation right like that where these two teams, based on what we've seen so far in the regular season and how they're playing now, I trust them more than I trust Philadelphia, more than I trust Toronto.
I agree, because people looking at Boston as the fifth seed and saying, oh, they're in trouble. No. Boston, I would not be the least bit surprised if they get to the finals. Because, as you say, all these issues they're having, Kyrie and the young guys and the back and forth and figuring it all out, they still went to Milwaukee, which has the second best home record in the league, and almost won. And like you said, could have easily won that game. So they're going to be a tough, tough out in the playoffs.
Is it?
I was going to say, and by the way, Eric Gordon probably found Kyrie on that last play. And by the way, also, the Celtics of those four teams are the ones with the most continuity.
Right.
Yes, they had the issue of trying to get Gordon and Irving reintegrated again, but that team's been together, and they were in Game 7 of the conference finals. They're the most proven commodity. Philly hasn't been that deep. Milwaukee, as we were just talking about, was a low seed a year ago. Toronto is new with Kawhi there. Boston's the team that has proven it.
Is it silly of us? I know when Victor Oladipo got hurt, we kind of wrote off Indiana. I'm not sure even anyone necessarily had them in their top four. They're currently sitting in the third seed still. Nate McMillan has done an incredible job. Maybe not necessarily to come out of the East, but do the Pacers concern you at all if they end up being in one of those top four spots? Do you anticipate them staying there? And is there a tough matchup for any of these teams against that Pacers group?
I would just say that the Pacers, for one, have hung incredibly tough without Oladipo and should not be counted out at all. I don't see them getting to necessarily to the semifinals or the conference finals, but could they play spoiler? Yeah, they absolutely could. Even if they slip to fifth, if you're the fourth seed, I don't think you want to see the Pacers in the first round.
Awesome. All right, Howard, stick around. We've got more with you coming up. Did last night prove the Lakers are playoff bound? That's next on First Things First. Back here on First Things First with Bleacher Report senior writer Howard Beck. Last night, the Lakers rallied from down 19 points in the third to take down the Rockets 111-106. LeBron led the way with 29 points, 11 boards, 6 assists. And the Lakers are now back at 500 and 2.5 games back of the eighth seed. Here is LeBron after the win.
You know, we got a fresh start for us, and it's the second half of the season. You know, the trade deadline is over with. This is our squad. I'm happy with who we got. I love our squad, and I look forward to seeing how we continue to battle for the rest of the season.
Howard, did LeBron prove last night that he can carry the Lakers into the playoffs?
He reminded us. I mean, I think he'd proven that before, right? And then he missed 17 games, and things kind of went haywire, and then they tried to trade his whole roster. So, no, I mean, the one thing we should not have doubts about the Lakers, and I don't think anybody really has, is that as long as healthy, LeBron's still LeBron. The question has always been about, what about the rest of these guys? Brandon Ingram had a huge game last night, and that was the guy that everybody was saying or expecting and hoping to see if you're a Laker fan. Where has that been? Can he keep doing that? Because LeBron needs a wingman at some point, and no one has emerged from that group. As much as that young group was hyped, no one has emerged, and that's why they were all on the trade block, because it was, you know, hey, you know, maybe somebody else can make better use of you. So I don't, you know, to me, it's never been about how far LeBron can carry the Lakers. It's how far those guys can support him to get him where he needs to go.
Well, here's the one thing, and to your point, I think LeBron hasn't gone out his way to get those guys involved early on in the season, because LeBron didn't know what was going to be possible or what wasn't going to be possible at the trade deadline. But now that these guys realize this is the team that they have moving forward, we're past the All-Star break, Like, this is the time of year where LeBron recognizes, okay, it's got to pick up. And it's probably a little earlier than he would like. Matter of fact, that's exactly what he said earlier in the week. Like, he has to turn it on a little earlier just based on the situation that they're in. But right now, they're 2.5 games behind the Clippers. The Warriors did them a solid by beating the Kings last night. So it's absolutely inside the realm of possibility that the Lakers could make a postseason push. But I think in order to do that, it's going to be on LeBron to get those young guys involved. And I think we saw glimpses of that last night, him deferring to Brandon Ingram and Kyle Kuzma in certain situations. I thought it was a sneaky good move at the deadline by Rob Pelinka and Magic Johnson to trade for Reggie Bullock because he provides some outside shooting. They can space the floor in half-court sets. But ultimately, it's going to come down to LeBron being able to trust those young guys because they're going to have to play an integral role if they're going to make a push for the postseason.
Yeah, I agree with you. It's never been about LeBron's production. Obviously, even in the first half when some people thought he wasn't playing as well, his numbers were still through the roof. But there have been questions, and fair ones, about his intensity, his energy, his defense, his engagement. And last night, I thought he brought all those things. There were times, a few times, where body language was bad, but that's to be expected maybe from any star player. But look, defensively, I thought he hustled. We saw him take the big charge late in the game. I think he set a good tone for the guys on that end of the floor. He guarded Clint Capela in spells. He doesn't really like guarding big men in the post. And then offensively, he moved more without the ball than I've seen him in a while. He posted up, you know, and sometimes I felt like he should have been more aggressive in trying to score in the post. He had Chris Paul on him sometimes, P.J. Tucker. But still, he was down there posting up, playing off the ball. I just think he set a better tone for all the other guys to follow. And now I don't think they're looking at it like, man, it's kind of LeBron and then the rest of us, and he's kind of looking at getting rid of us anyway. Now I think they're saying, okay, he's engaged. We're all in this together. Let's follow the leader.
And it seemed like that. It seemed much more of a collective effort. He's activated not only in his play but also mentally engaged with these guys. Howard, do you think Brandon Ingram is the most important piece, the most important factor aside from LeBron to help get them there? Who, when you look at this roster and you look at these players, what guys need to make sure that they are consistently impactful for this Lakers team to get to the postseason?
Yeah, you could go any number of directions with this, Sarah, right? Like, Brandon Ingram is the guy who can do the most. I mean, he's a versatile wingman for LeBron, a guy who can also handle the ball, make plays, score when he's on his best nights, and a versatile defender. But you could say that Lonzo Ball is key because this team, when it's been at its best defensively, it's with Lonzo at the point, and they got to get him back healthy. But it's, you know, this is not a proven group. Let's remember, this is a group that was in the lottery for the last several years without LeBron, and he's still new to them. And I think we kind of keep forgetting about, look, there's still an integration process that goes on over the course of a season here.
Keep going. Sorry.
Yeah, no, but Ingram is the guy who I think had to make one of the biggest adjustments. Not having the ball in his hands as much, not being able to try to lead the way. We saw him try to do a little bit when LeBron was out. Mixed results. But I feel like if he really emerges, they're solid. They're in great shape. They're going to make the postseason.
What do you think the integration process will be like for Lonzo Ball when he comes back? How challenging do you think that will be for both Ball and for LeBron in this group?
I think it's going to be really tough because if these guys really get on a roll, and, you know, last night, look, we've seen some false starts by the Lakers before, so let's not get ahead of ourselves. But if they really get on a roll, and that's happening without Lonzo Ball, and you've already got, you know, LeBron has the ball in his hands, and Rondo's got the ball in his hands, and Ingram can do a lot with the ball in his hands. Lonzo's going to have to try to figure out, well, where do I fit in this? Because that's really the one thing he does, that and defense. You know, he's not going to sit out there as a spot-up shooter. We know that. So, yeah, I think that's going to be one of those key questions down the stretch.
Yeah, I've wondered about it because they do play him a lot as a spot-up shooter, you know, because LeBron has the ball. But if Bullock can bring what he brought last night. He is their best three-point shooter.
Yeah.
That's why they signed him. He hit, what, four last night, I think,
yeah,
with 14 points.
Yeah.
If he does that, I'm with you. Like, Lonzo is great for their defense. But if Bullock is shooting the ball like that, where does he fit in offensively? That's an interesting question. Maybe he takes Rondo's minutes, you know, but it'll be interesting.
Cansey brought up a great point about LeBron saying that he has gotten himself, you know, a little bit earlier than he's anticipated, ready for his postseason form play. Do you think LeBron could sustain this at this age, at his mileage? You know, do you anticipate that he can play in this manner and with this engagement throughout the course of these last last 24 games?
I have no doubt about it as long as he stays healthy. I mean, the guy is superhuman. He seems indestructible. We saw a little bit of a nick in that, you know, with the groin injury. But as long as LeBron's healthy, I mean, what have we seen that would make any of us doubt that LeBron can sustain it at this level? I think he can. I think he will. I think they're going to lock down one of those last playoff spots in the West. They've got two games left against the Clippers and one against the Kings. They've got every opportunity to make that push.
Yeah, I trust LeBron James when he says that he's going to ratchet up the intensity. I think this is going to be his sustained level of play, but it's more about being able to trust the young guys. And I think that LeBron James showing those guys that he trusts them in big spots goes a long ways in terms of being able to instill confidence in them. And a confident player that understands his role is going to be a more effective player. And confidence also comes from demonstrated performance. So I think those young guys proved something to themselves last night, mainly Brandon Ingram and Kyle Kuzma, because you saw in certain situations late in that game, LeBron James deferred to the young guys. So if they can continue to have that kind of rapport moving forward down this down the end of the regular season, I think they'll find themselves making it to the postseason.
Yeah, and I think something that's going to help him stay motivated to play at this level the rest of the regular season is that, look, he won't admit it, and I'm not suggesting he's happy or satisfied with anything but a championship, but he knows in his heart of hearts, getting this team to the playoffs at this point is a victory. Even if you go there and get swept by Golden State or beat in five games, and I think he's also pushing for that seventh seed. Like, because I believe if they get to seven, and I know Denver is a very good team, but they're nothing special on the road, and none of them have any type of postseason experience, I would take LeBron James in that series with Denver. So I think he's probably eyeing, I'm not just trying to get in at eight. I'm trying to get in at seven, and maybe we can make some noise.
Awesome. Howard, thank you so much for being here with us.
Thank you.
And you got an extraordinary podcast, the full 48.
Full 48, thank you.
Yeah, listen, it's great stuff.
Always good.
Coming up, could Russell Wilson be taking his talents to another NFL team? That's next on First Things First. Russell Wilson, one of the best quarterbacks in the NFL, is hitting the final year of his contract. And one would assume he would want to be a Seahawk for life. But friend of the show, Colin Cowherd, proposed an interesting theory about the Seattle quarterback. Take a listen.
The rumor I'm going to tell you about, I was told this yesterday. This is happening in the entertainment agent world. Everybody will deny it. It's not good to be out now. But Russell Wilson's wife is Sierra. She is a singer and an entertainer. She would prefer to live in New York, and the Giants need a quarterback, and there's nobody in the draft they love. So just remember this. A lot of things add up. Last year of Russell's contract, his wife would prefer New York. Seattle is not an entertainment mecca. Okay? New York needs, the Giants need a star quarterback to replace Eli.
Seattle is not an entertainment mecca. Canning, is it crazy to think that Russell Wilson wants out of Seattle?
Yeah, that's crazy to think. Because the really? Seattle Seahawks, John Schneider and Pete Carroll, have handed him the franchise right now. So and when's the last time you've seen a franchise quarterback in his prime get traded or let walk in free agency? It just doesn't happen. Chris, so I mean, I'm looking at this situation right now. I think this is more speculation, more conjecture, and there's nothing like motivating your team to give you some fresh cash with your team floating the rumor out there that you want to go play elsewhere. So I think a lot of this has to do with Russell Wilson wanting to get his new contract in 2019, get an extension. You saw Aaron Rodgers got the extension before last football season. He's getting $34 million a year. Russell Wilson is looking at the $22 million he's making and saying, it's about time for that pay raise. Right. So I mean, I think that's really what all of this comes down to, is the Seattle Seahawks locking up Russell Wilson throughout the rest of his prime, because you're talking about a Super Bowl winning quarterback that's 31 years old. I mean, he's got another good 8 to 10 years left in him to play football if he wants to. So I don't envision Russell Wilson playing for another team. So I think that this is something where the Seattle Seahawks and Russell Wilson will make sure that they continue this relationship moving forward.
I wouldn't be mad at him for doing what his beautiful wife wants to do. She wants to go to New York. Look, all the reports are that he hasn't talked to the Seahawks about this at all, that there's no inkling that he wants out. And as you say, look, we'll know this summer. I mean, they're certainly going to start talks this summer and try to lock him up. Yeah, I mean, look, Seattle's been great for him. He is his franchise. They got rid of the guys that were kind of, you know, at odds with him in the locker room. It's his team. I personally would love to see him in New York. You give him, I mean, with OBJ, Evan Ingram, Saquon Barkley, he could do major damage there. And I think he has the mentality, the maturity, the temperament to handle New York. He's the adult in the room. Mm-hmm. And Eli's kind of like that. You know, yep. Eli's not – he's a little different personality than Russell, but he's a solid character guy that you don't have to worry about being able to handle New York City. Russell would be the same thing. Look, it might be a total fantasy, yep. You know, with Colin. But I would love to see. I kind of hope it's true.
Well, you saw OBJ catching passes from Russell Wilson because right. They've been working out this offseason.
Whether it's true or not, how do you think that Russell would fit with the Giants?
I think it'd be a perfect fit because the issue for the Giants has been on the offensive side of the ball, the offensive line not keeping the quarterback upright. But Russell Wilson, based on his skill set and being able to extend plays with his legs, he would be able to overcome that deficiency. So, yeah, Russell Wilson would absolutely fit with the New York Giants. There aren't too many teams where Russell Wilson wouldn't fit as the quarterback because you're talking about one of the elite quarterbacks in our game. I mean, on anybody's list, he should be top five. I think Russell Wilson is just that special. So, I mean, yeah, would Russell Wilson fit with the New York Giants? Absolutely. In the glut of talent that they have at the skill positions with Sterling Shepard and Evan Ingram and OBJ and Saquon Barkley, who led the NFL in yards from scrimmage. I mean, that would be a really dynamic offense.
What about the Seahawks? Are they set up to succeed next season?
I didn't think they were set up to succeed this season. And he's that good. I mean, he can make lemonade out of lemons, and that's what he did. So they obviously have work to do. They have to add some pieces around him. But as long as they have him in the mix and Pete Carroll, he just signed an extension, so he'll be there for a while. Yeah, they're not going away. I mean, the time for them to go away was this year, and they showed that they're not. So, yeah, I think they're going to be in that playoff hunt for the next few years.
Yeah, I think they were retooling this team. Defensively, they had to overcome a lot of losses. Of course, Richard Sherman has been gone. Cam Chancellor couldn't play this year. Earl Thomas got hurt earlier in the season. So, I mean, it was Bobby Wagner, Frank Clark, and others. And so I think it was a little tough for them to be able to make a push, but they still found themselves in the playoffs, and that's behind Russell Wilson, but also behind a really strong running game. Keep in mind, that was the number one rush offense in the National Football League. So, yeah, they need another playmaker on the offensive side of the ball. I think Antonio Brown would be really interesting. Couple him with Doug Baldwin. I think that could be something that works out for the Seattle Seahawks. But I think this is the offseason that they'll add some pieces for Russell because they got some cap space to work with. They have the eighth most cap space going into free agency at the start of the new league year in March. So I think the Seattle Seahawks are in a really good spot.
So, Chris, would you, if you're Seattle, are you going hard for Antonio? You got the cap room. He wants some guaranteed money. Would you go hard at him? What would you offer?
Yeah, listen, I got to make life a little bit easier for Russell Wilson. Now it's a matter of the compensation going back to the Pittsburgh Steelers. But you got to think that the Steelers would probably be motivated to send Antonio Brown out of the AFC. They don't want to have him being on one of their direct competitors, especially when it gets to the postseason. So, I mean, you're probably talking about a late first-round pick or, you know, a high second-round pick in terms of the value that Antonio Brown would warrant. But I think
they first might get it.
I think the Seattle Seahawks could make something like that work out because when you look at the NFL draft and the prospects coming out of the college ranks, there really aren't a whole lot of playmakers in terms of the wide receiver position. So I think this would give Russell Wilson another toy and make things a lot easier on the offensive side.
Do you think he and Wilson would, because, you know, Richard Sherman and some guys like that had issues with Russell? You think Antonio and Russell are a good fit personality-wise?
Well, I think from a leadership standpoint, Russell Wilson is, a better complement for what Antonio Brown is from the personality standpoint and from a production standpoint. Because keep in mind, Ben Roethlisberger wasn't the hardest worker on the Pittsburgh Steelers. It was Antonio Brown. But all of the things that we've heard from the Seattle Seahawks is that Russell Wilson works harder than anybody else in the building. So I think that Antonio Brown being in that situation, especially if they decide they're going to give him some more guaranteed money on his contract, I think AB would be happy with that. And then, of course, Russell Wilson, his resume, his pedigree, I think they'll be a good fit.
Time for them to level up.
I like that. I mean, you're not level hearing up. I haven't heard a lot about Seattle and Antonio.
Well, there wasn't no Seattle, Green Bay,
you
Philadelphia.
You didn't get my Sierra right. song reference. Like no? That. Level up? You know the song?
Level up?
Oh,
coming up.
I'm
the
sorry.
The Bucs were the best team they each last night. That's we next up, first things first. You know, Kyrie and the Celtics taking on Giannis and the Bucks last night. Less than 6 minutes to go, and Chris Middleton misses the shot. Outlet pass to Jason Tatum, and Giannis watch out, coming from behind, chase down block. He got it done on the defensive end. He also would finish the night with 30 points. Now, less than two to go, Celtics down one. Kyrie, this is crazy. Ridiculous up and under. Game tied at 95 now. And then Middleton, once again, the go-ahead three. So Kyrie has a chance to win it at the buzzer. No good, though. Bucks would win this one 98-97. Kenny, what did last night tell you about the East?
I think that last night told me that the East is going to come down to these two teams. I mean, as closely contested as that game was, I really like what the Milwaukee Bucks are, especially defensively. And then, of course, you're talking about them having the best basketball player in the conference in Giannis Antetokounmpo. I know you said you have him right there at the top of the MVP race this year. I mean, I guess it's going to come down to him and James Harden more than likely. But, I mean, just the way that they commit to playing team defense. I mean, that's been a point of emphasis for their new head coach. And, of course, that team is able to make that jump from the bottom half of the Eastern Conference to the top because their best player has accepted the challenge of being one of those guys that has that intense presence on the defensive end of the court. But then you look at the Boston Celtics as well, and that's a team that's been trying to figure it out, having Kyrie Irving back and healthy this year, Gordon Hayward back. It's not enough touches on the offensive end in terms of being able to distribute and get it all to the all your playmakers. But I think that once the Boston Celtics figure out how to play with one another, they'll be the team that the Milwaukee Bucks have to face at the end in the Eastern Conference. So I really think that one of these two teams is ultimately going to be the team representing the East in the NBA Finals.
Think about what you said. Once Boston figures it out, they still haven't figured it out. We see the comments going back and forth, the young guys, Kyrie Irving, is he staying? Are the young guys happy with their roles? All of that is out there, and they still went into Milwaukee and almost beat the Bucks. The Bucks had the second best home record in the league. They almost beat them on their home floor. People looking at Boston's fifth seed and thinking, oh, this is a bad year. They're not what we thought they were. No, they're going to be there. They're going to be a tough out. I put Toronto on the level with these two teams. But
I like what Masai Ujiri did and traded for Marcus Gasol at the deadline,
right,
too. I think that was a good move.
That's a nice move. So. Yeah. Boston, I would not be the least bit surprised if Boston wins the East. I'm picking Milwaukee with a little hesitation. I think any pick in this conference is you're hesitant because they're all so close. But Boston is going to be right there. And then Milwaukee, you mentioned the defensive end. I mean, they're the only team in the league in the top five in both offensive and defensive efficiency. And what I like about them that you don't see with other teams, the ball finds the open man late in the game. Giannis is, for all that the other things he brings, he's the third leading scorer in the league in the fourth quarter. But in the fourth quarter, they're not all Giannis all the time. They're not predictable. You saw Eric Bledsoe score a big bucket late on the drive to the basket. Mm-hmm. Chris Middleton hits the big three-pointer with 32 seconds left. Other teams, we know it's going to Kyrie. We know it's going to Kawhi. We know it's going to LeBron. We know it's going to Harden or whatever. I like their equal opportunity feel at the end of the game, even though you do have a superstar. It makes them less predictable.
I couldn't agree with that more. And I think you look at a team like Milwaukee, and I agree with your points on Boston, but what Mike Budenholzer has done and changed the complexion of how they play offensively, they're shooting so many more three-point shots, and you know, they haven't changed the team much. So the composition is the same. The core is the same. You've got Giannis, Chris Middleton, Eric Bledsoe, Malcolm Brogdon, who have been together for a long time. Mm-hmm. But I think the pickup of Brook Lopez and you know, Ersan Ilyasova, of course, how many minutes is he going to play? Nikola Mirotic, you've got three bigs that you could play next to Giannis. So what does that do? That stretches out the floor. Mm-hmm. It opens up the floor. Giannis's biggest strength, of course, is getting to the basket, how he scores in the paint. He doesn't need to shoot from the outside because now they've got players that spread the floor, balance the floor. I think there's such a threat on the offensive end now. To your point, the balance, everyone on that team has the ability to hit big shots. I believe they have the confidence to do it. And then defensively, when you've got a lockdown defensive team that does so much with their length, their versatility, they're multi-positional. I mean, really, you go down the look of their lineup and they can guard 1 through 5. They can switch. I'm really impressed with what they've done so far this season. And it's going to be fun. The tough part is these two may be seeing each other in the conference semifinals. Right. Yep. If Boston ends up in the four seed.
Right. Yeah, well, either way, I think the Bucks realize they're going to have to deal with the Celtics at some point after how last night's game unfolded. Because, I mean, we were just a foul away from Kyrie Irvin going to the free throw line and putting two in and icing that game. But in terms of the Milwaukee Bucks and how they play, Sarah, you mentioned it. You talked about their offensive efficiency and how that's improved this season. I think that's a product of what they do on the defensive end of the court. And their ability to be able to match up with different people and being able to switch on pick and roll situations. I think that based on how today's game is played, I think they have enough versatility on that side of the court where they can neutralize whatever schemes, whatever personnel that groups that the opposing team is marching out there. And then, of course, being so good on the defensive end is going to lead to opportunities in transition on the offensive end. And so I think that's why we've seen this team take the next step. It starts with the defensive side of the court and everybody on the court committing to playing team defense, because not everybody wants to play defense.
Right.
Defense is not fun. Defense is ultimately effort and want to. But I think that Mike Budenholzer has done that. He's gotten those guys to buy in, and that's why they're having a success this season.
Quickly, the one question about Milwaukee is the lack of experience going deep into the playoffs. Because Boston has it not only in going to the seventh game last year with Eastern Conference Finals without Kyrie, but obviously Kyrie has won a championship and been to the finals plenty of times. Toronto, they've gone deep into the playoffs together. And then with Kawhi and Danny Green, that's a lot of championship pedigree. So Milwaukee doesn't have that. That's the one question about them that I don't have about the other
team. I'm with you on that. The one thing I will say, though, is that they've been to the postseason now, this group together for three straight years. So I feel like this may be the time they take the jump. And for as much as we talk about the Warriors playing with joy and liking each other and appreciating one another, you see that with this group. Mm-hmm. All right, back to the NFL. Le'Veon Bell missed all of the 2018 season after never signing his franchise tender, and reports are the running back had become overweight in his year away. However, L. Bell's trainer disputes the rumors that he is out of shape. Canty, should teams be worried about signing Le'Veon?
No, I don't think there's anything to worry about. And just a little context on the report, it came out from Manish Mehta of the Daily News, and he's been the beat writer for the Jets for some time. So I think this might be the Jets greasing the skids just a little bit in case they don't land Le'Veon Bell in free agency.
But in case, or putting it out there that this is why we might not go as hard at him.
Well, I don't think it makes sense based on where their team is offensively not to make a push for a skill position player like Le'Veon Bell, because Sam Darnold doesn't really have a lot of weapons to speak of on the offensive end. They re-signed Quincy Enunwa, and they're in it to try to retain Robbie Anderson. But, I mean, Le'Veon Bell, by far and away, would be the most explosive weapon that Sam Darnold has to work with. And they just hired Adam Gase, of course, with Sam Darnold's development in mind. But I think this is a situation where there's enough time right now between, you know, when teams report for the offseason workouts and then, of course, the training camp for Le'Veon Bell to make sure that he's in shape and make sure that, you know, he's in, you know, good condition, getting ready for the grind that is the NFL season. I'm not worried about Le'Veon Bell. I think, if anything, the year off benefited him, because going into last year, he's led the league in touches and yards from scrimmage in every single game since he's come into the league. So, I mean, you look at that span of when he was drafted till the beginning of last year, he was number one in all of those categories in terms of touches and yards from scrimmage. So I think, if anything, the year off benefited him, and now you're getting a situation where you're going to get a happy Le'Veon Bell because he's going to have the financial security that he's been looking for.
Yeah, look, I'm not worried about him being out of shape. I'm with you there. That doesn't really concern me. Maybe you should post something on Instagram of him working out with his abs or something like that.
But we ain't got enough of Steelers posting stuff on social media.
We ain't got enough of that.
I'm just saying, dispel the rumors. But Chris, though, I do have questions only in this. If I'm a team like the Jets, I want Le'Veon Bell. You're right. I mean, he can help Darnold not only with his running ability, but with his pass-catching ability out of the backfield. But I want him at the right price. And I don't think Le'Veon would be happy at what most teams will think is the right price. Mm. Like, he wants to break the bank. And it's nothing against him. I just have a hard time breaking the bank for a running back in today's NFL. When I look at, you know, Philip Lindsay, an undrafted rookie who was a top 10 rusher and averaged 5.5 yards a carry in Denver. When I look at Chris Carson, a 7th-round draft pick. Even Kareem Hunt and Alvin Kamara were 3rd-round draft picks. I think I can get a really productive running back who maybe is not quite as good as Le'Veon, but he's with the price is so much less that I think I can get somebody. Even in Pittsburgh, James Conner, maybe, you know, wasn't as flashy as Le'Veon, and I'm not saying he was as good as Le'Veon, but his production was better until he got hurt. He averaged more yards per carry. He had, in only 13 games, he had more touchdowns rushing than Le'Veon ever had in a season. He averaged more yards per carry on catches. He didn't have as many catches. He had a good amount, 55, but he had more yards per catch than Le'Veon has in the last 3 years. Le'Veon only averaged 4 yards a carry in his last year with the Steelers. So, I look, would I give him something close to Todd Gurley money? Maybe. But I don't know if that's going to make Le'Veon happy. That's my only concern. You see reports he wants $50 million in the first 2 years. I saw one, Manish's report said $48 million first 3 years. That's the only thing that scares me. And is he going to be happy if he doesn't get that money?
Well, here's the thing. I think the price will be right for Le'Veon Bell because the Jets and the Colts both have over $100 million in cap space, and both of them had a need at the running back position. But here's where I'll say numbers will lie to you. When you're comparing the production that James Conner gave you to what Le'Veon Bell was able to give you in the seasons prior, Le'Veon Bell helped this offense in so many different ways that you can't quantify because he opens up everything for everyone. I remember when I was playing for the Baltimore Ravens and we were game planning for the Pittsburgh Steelers offense. The game plan revolved around stopping number 26, not number 84, not number 7. And so I think you have to understand the threat that Le'Veon Bell brings, not just as a running back in the backfield, but also as a receiver. So you might classify him as a running back, but he's a playmaker. And then you look at last year, the Pittsburgh Steelers as a team in their run production, they're one of the worst teams in the NFL. So, I mean, I understand that James Conner stepped in and did an admirable job. But, I mean, in terms of the comparison with Le'Veon Bell, there is no comparison. And I don't think there's any question that he's going to get his money from somebody in the NFL because he is a free agent. And I think that $45 million guaranteed, what Todd Gurley got last year and a contract extension, is going to be the going rate for Le'Veon Bell.
All right, coming up, did last night prove the Lakers are playoff bound? That's next on First Things First. Tivis One is your destination for the day's best sports shows. Tune in for the biggest personalities on the biggest stories, of course. We get you started right here with First Things First. You can catch it all Monday through Friday on FS1. Welcome back to the show, and we got a very special guest, 11-year NBA vet Randy Foy. Of course, NBA, but you're a Villanova Wildcat great, former Big East Player of the Year. You've done it all. Thanks for being here with us.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it. What's going on
with Villanova right now, man?
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to figure out.
St. John's?
Yeah, we got a
Georgetown?
Great
coach.
They need
what's really happening?
You got eligibility left?
We got a great coach. We should be all right. Trust me.
Okay. All right.
For sure. All right. Let's talk about LeBron James, who said he had activated his playoff intensity. Lakers rallied from down 19 points in the third quarter to take down the Rockets, 111-106 last night. LeBron led the way with 29 points, 11 boards, and 6 assists. Lakers now back at 500 and 2.5 games back of the 8th seed. Here's LeBron after the win.
You know, we got a fresh start for us, and it's the second half of the season. And, you know, the trade deadline is over with. This is our squad. I'm happy with who we got. I love our squad, and I look forward to seeing how we continue to battle for the rest of the season.
Randy, do you think last night proved that LeBron can help carry this Lakers team into the postseason?
Absolutely. I think that throughout his career, he has shown that he can take less talent and do some big things on the floor. The way he played last night, I think he can do more. I want to see him do more. I want to see him score the ball more. I want to see him play like James Harden. If he play like that, he's going to bring those guys with him. Those guys, those younger guys who's walking around with bad body language. I want LeBron to shoot the ball every chance he get to show that he could put this team on his back. And if he do that, they'll be all right. But the bad thing is that they'll be the AFC and they will be swept by the Golden State Warriors in the first round of
the playoffs. So you don't see any chance of them getting the 7?
Nah. Because the way the Los Angeles Clippers are playing and Sacramento Kings are playing, there's no way. They're going to make them fight for every inch to get into the playoffs all the way through April.
Randy, you've been on the floor with LeBron James countless times. Do you think, though, not that he has it, of course he can do that, but do you think he has that mindset, he has that attitude that he would take over and shoot every time up the court and be that dominant on the offensive end in terms of looking for his own shot?
You know, selfishly, as a former player and watching LeBron play, I want to see him come down every time and shoot the ball. I want him to be James Harden when Chris Paul was out. But I know that he won't do it. I watched him last night drive to the basket, get into the lane, the defense collapsed. and he kicked it out to Reggie Bullock, who knocked down a big three during the game. Just the way LeBron approaches the game is to make everyone else better. That's why I think the Lakers are struggling this year, because they don't have the shooters around him. These guys, you need shooters around him to be great. Like, JaVale McGee is a great guy for a live guy. They just got Reggie Bullock in a trade. If those guys can make threes, they can do some great things. But if those guys don't make threes and open up the floor for him, they probably won't make the playoffs.
No, I absolutely agree with you. You got to have shooting to be able to space the floor, especially in half-court sets. And you know LeBron, when you have a team where he's the focal point, it's going to be a little bit slower of a pace. And so I think those young guys have to get a feel for what LeBron wants to do. But I think, in part, those guys being more involved now, it comes down to those guys understanding that they're going to be here. Right, because the last couple of months before the trade deadline, all of their names have been included in trade rumors for Anthony Davis, trying to make a move to bring him over. And you know that he's represented by Clutch Sports and Rich Paul, so people are connecting the dots. But those guys in the locker room, you know, they're a little bit on edge because they don't know what their future is going to entail. But now that we're past the trade deadline, I think everybody understands that they're going to be around. This is going to be the team if they're going to make a push. Those young guys are going to have to be involved. And so I think it goes both ways in terms of the relationship between LeBron and those young guys. I think he's going to have to trust them a little more, and them in turn being able to, you know, being able to reassure LeBron that that trust is well placed, and they'll be able to make the requisite plays when the opportunities present themselves.
Randy, how much, when you were a young player in the league and you first start hearing your name and trade rumors and all that, how long does it take you to get over that? Because they got to get over it. Hopefully they're over it now. But they have to get over that and move on. You know, how tough can that be for a young player?
Like, to be honest with you, you never get over it. Because I remember when I was in Minnesota, I was playing, and my name was in countless rumors about bringing AI. And I remember opening up, watching SportsCenter, and seeing KG saying, AI, we want you, come on. But I knew if AI was traded to the Timberwolves, I was going to the Sixers.
Right.
So that, just being in the back of my mind, it just made me go out and play selfish, saying, hey, I'm going to shoot the ball every time. Every chance I get, I'm going to shoot the ball. So I think for those younger guys, they need to just look and say, hey, we're playing with greatness, and this guy's going to get us to where we need to go, and they need to jump on board.
So it makes it tougher even when you see – when a teammate – you know, because obviously they were – LeBron was tied to wanting to get AD.
Yes,
you mentioned, that makes it even worse.
That's even worse. Like, you know, like last night LeBron in his post-game interview, he said – well, you know, we're trying to – these guys are going to be here for the rest of the year. And when someone says that, you know exactly what's going on. These guys are going to be here for the rest of the year. But when July 1st come around, right, or the draft, right, even the draft come around, Anthony Davis' name is going to be brought up again. And the front office, LeBron, Magic, Pelinka, those guys are going to have to sit down and make a decision what's right for the team, even if it isn't Anthony Davis, because LeBron's getting older.
Oh,
so
yeah.
They're going to have to bring some guys in that's going to be able to help them, that's going to be able to score 20 to 25 a night. Not just one guy, but two guys to get where they want to go.
Randy, I know you've never been teammates with LeBron James, but you did have many dominant teammates, including Russell Westbrook. What's the challenge for a lot of these young players playing with someone like LeBron and trying to integrate yourself and acclimate yourself to his style of play and how he plays?
Just understand that everything's about him. Everything's about him, every single play down the court. Post-game interviews, when people see you on the street, hey, man, how's LeBron doing? They don't even ask about you. And you looking like, man, I play for the team too, but yeah, how's LeBron doing? But everything's about him. And I think one thing they need to understand is that they are playing with greatness. This guy, four-time MVP award winner, 9 finals, straight finals, just being out there and being great. You want to be a part of that. Like, I get it. You're so competitive as a young player where you're saying to yourself, hey, I was drafted number 2. He was drafted number 1. I could shoot the ball. I could handle the ball. I could do a lot of the things that he can do. But you're not LeBron. You need to learn from him, and you need to learn from this situation, because you're going to be in so many trade rumors. So many different teams are going to want you. Is something that you need to learn from and get past.
With that being said, Lonzo Ball expected to come back sometime soon. How challenging will it be for him to reacclimate himself to not only playing with LeBron, but playing with this group?
I don't think it's going to be challenging for him to come back, because he's used to it. You know, everything that goes on with his dad, he's used to the noise from outside. But I think for Luke Walton, it's challenging. You know, a guy like Josh Hart, who didn't play in the first half, you know, you play a guy like Lance Stephenson, and then Josh Hart comes in, even though I'm being biased right now.
I was going to say, you're shouting out your Wildcat.
Even though I'm being biased right now, but he comes in, And his numbers don't jump out at you, but if you look at what he did on the defensive end, offensive rebound, sacrificing his body, he had a big part of helping the Lakers win last night. So I think it's more challenging for Luke Walton to get all of those guys' minutes.
Thank you for listening to the First Things First podcast. Remember, leave us a review and tell us what you think. Subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts and catch us on FS1 Monday through Friday, 6:30 a.m. Eastern. For Chris Carter and Nick Wright, I'm Jenna Wolf. So long, everybody.